you know, I think that there's some interesting things happening in the world today. I mean, 10 years ago, we weren't having many conversations about food waste, and there are a lot more of those happening now. So, you know, step one is awareness. And I think that it's good that different places are exploring different ways of addressing this, because I don't think we know what the proper solution is going to be.
Welcome to MeatsPad, a platform dedicated to sharing breakthrough knowledge that is accessible to the meats industry. On each episode, we will hear from meat specialists and professionals to talk about numerous topics in meat science. These discussions help foster and improve communication and knowledge dissemination within the meat science community. This podcast is brought to you by the U.S. Meat Export Federation, the National Provisioner, Ultrasource, the new standard for innovation, Dry Age Pro, makes dry aging in-house flexible, safe, and affordable.
ViscoFan, the casing company.
The mission of USMEF is to increase the value and profitability of the U.S. beef, pork, and lamb industries by enhancing demand for their products in export markets through a dynamic partnership of all stakeholders. Simply put, USMEF is putting U.S. meat on the world's table.
Hello, meat folks. Welcome back to the MeatsPad podcast. Today we have a fantastic guest. We have Jack Bubbo, author of the book, Why Smart People Make Bad Food Choices. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for coming in. And I'm grateful that you're here. You know, I have had a chance to listen to you speak, and I like the perspective that you bring. And for the audience out there, Jack is CEO of Futurity. Is that correct?
That's right. Okay. Sounds like a made-up word, but it's not.
No, yeah. Well, and thinking about ways that the public's perception is going to continue to develop over time, and especially when it comes to around food and food choices. And some of the background that I did a little bit of reading on you, Jack, and one of the topics that really stuck out was, why is food such a hot topic, and why is it a feared topic? And to me, I'm not scared of food. I love food. I run toward food, but you're right. I think there is a lot of controversy and question. And so tell us a little bit about that thought process.
Yeah. Well, one thing I would say is that people have never cared more where their food comes from. And because people are so passionate about food, they want to influence what happens with food. But because we're so far removed from how food is produced these days, what we're asking for and what we want may no longer be the same thing. And it's interesting when you ask people, like, how much do you think you know about food production? People in cities often think they know more than people who live in rural communities. Whereas people in rural communities who aren't in ag, they know nothing. But people in cities, they're like, yeah, you know, I spent a weekend, you know, at a local farm, so I figured it out. So on one hand, I think it's a great thing that people do care about how food is produced, because, you know, how food is produced is critically important to the future of the planet. But without that grounding and experience, it's also dangerous, because we may not get the future we want if we ask for things that aren't going to get us there.
You know what? I'm glad you bring it up, because I know I had a conversation a couple weeks ago, and they asked a consumer, I think it was that video kind of was out there for a while, do you know where milk comes from? And they said it comes from the fridge. So that really, it was kind of a miscommunication, lack of knowledge about where the food's coming from. And I think this is highly important.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. There was one study, I can't remember, it was Consumers International or somebody, a Consumers Union, that had asked people, you know, do you think there's dairy in, you know, almond milk or soy milk? And the headlines were all that, you know, most consumers are not confused that, you know, whether there's actual milk in plant-based milk. But when you look at the data, I mean, it was like 10%, you know, had no idea, or 10% thought there was milk in it, and like 15% weren't sure. So it was like 20 to 30% of people who actually were confused. And so, I mean, personally, I was actually surprised that the number was that high. So, I mean, there's some actual confusion going on. I don't think that it's critical. I mean, people are confused about all sorts of things. But, you know, it's one thing if they're actually confused. There's another about the nutritional aspect of it. You know, do you think that it serves the same role in your diet? And, you know, that's a deeper question that, you know, I think we're only beginning to get to. Do the nutritional impacts of eating meat or, you know, consuming dairy give you the same impact? And I don't think we quite know yet. It's not that I'm afraid of these alternatives, but I think that there are real questions about how do they fit into a nutritious diet.
Yes, we had a pleasure to meet on a bus, but we started the conversation. I introduced myself and I started just discussing about some of my projects on food waste and how we manage shrink at the retail level, but also at the processing level. And we just kept that conversation going. So what do you think, and we talk about, I mean, you being pretty much everywhere, French is your third language or second language. So what's your perspective on sustainability as far as food waste? We mentioned a little bit of the challenges at the retail level. So can you give us some perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is that, you know, there has been a lot of progress at reducing food waste over time. You know, we think things are bad today, but, you know, the meat industry in particular has been quite good at, you know, their, I think the motto for the renderers is everything but the oink, right? That, you know, they use it all, you know, very effectively. And, you know, in some ways, it's become a bad thing that we're using these things so efficiently. And, you know, that's quite unfortunate because, you know, it brings the cost down, improves the quality, ensures that, you know, animals don't go to waste. But I think that there's a realization that there is still more that we can do and that we are obligated to make sure that we do it. I think it's worth remembering that there's no reason, nobody wants food waste. So there's like nobody who really benefits from food waste in the supply chain. And so if it exists because it's not that easy to fix. So doesn't mean we shouldn't try, doesn't mean we won't be successful, but food waste is not one problem. It's 1,000 problems for all these different products. You know, the three most wasted food items are bread, potatoes, and apples, and how you would address food waste in those three categories are quite different. And then, of course, there's just the idea that 40% of food is wasted post-consumer in the U.S. and other developed countries. And getting consumers to address food waste is a different challenge than, you know, being more productive and efficient in the retail environment. Things that we can do there, you know, a lot of consumers are confused by Best Buy versus Used By dates, and that's just an easy fix. I mean, we absolutely should address a problem if consumers are throwing things away because they don't know if it's good. Just because it's past that date, I mean, that should just never happen. I mean, most of those are quality standards, and people should understand the difference between a quality and a safety issue.
Yeah, just because it says Best Buy, that doesn't mean it's an expired date.
Yeah, well, my wife's from China, and I tell you, you know, she does not believe Best Buy means you should throw it away. She means, you know, she and I are going to eat it.
Yeah, it may not taste as good as the day you purchased it, right?
Right.
Well, and that's a good point for our listeners out there, especially in the processed meats category, our small to medium-sized processors that have a retail outlet. Make sure you do talk about that with your customers and especially ones that are purchasing prepackaged product or even the big retailers that are making case-ready product. Have some type of educational information out there to talk about how you don't have to throw this away just because it's beyond this particular date. It's literally, this is more of a quality issue than a safety.
Right. And there just may be different uses for it. You know, you might have used it, you know, in one way, but as it's, you know, a little bit older, maybe you make it into a soup, you do other things with it. And, you know, that's what our parents and our grandparents were doing for a very long time. They understood, you know, things are going to start to, won't be as good. And so we need to do something different with it. Lost some of that cultural knowledge that we used to have.
Absolutely. Well, and that's a really good point you're bringing up. Most of the folks that were born during or survived through the Depression, they're not with us anymore. And so we don't have that influence of use every scrap of everything. I can't think of the saying, but it's literally, you know, use it till it's worn out or do without. And that has a lot to do with the food waste that's happening. But it's also, I believe it may be contributing a little bit to some of the other challenges that us in society may be encountering. And this is in a more global sense. And I know you've mentioned in the past talking about those that are undernourished, which should not be happening. There's plenty of food around. We just need to be able to get it to them in some cases. The deforestation, that is a concern, especially in animal agriculture. We need to be very conscious of utilizing the land that we have in the most appropriate way. And you actually provide some pretty cool data on we're not necessarily making enormous slash and burn situations like maybe have been in the past. We're actually using the land very well now, and we're just that much more efficient. And I'm going to stop my point here, and I want you to elaborate on this. And forgive me if I don't get the exact quote down, but you mentioned one of the things is that agriculture may be the problem needing solved, but it's also likely the solution.
Yeah, well, some of that goes to the question of how do we frame the conversation? You know, is agriculture the problem that needs to be solved, or is it the solution to our problem? And how we choose to frame it will determine whether or not those who are invested in the ag system work with us or feel like they're under attack and they circle the wagons and, you know, they feel like, you know, I don't want to engage in these conversations. And a lot of that goes to what do we use as the baseline? If we talk about all the problems of agriculture on land and water and climate, it really sounds like agriculture is the problem. But if we look how far we've come, I think it becomes much more clear that agriculture is getting better every single day, but maybe not fast enough. But that's a different problem to have. I mean, if people are trying but not doing as much as you'd like them to do, well, you don't beat those people up. You give them a helping hand. You provide incentives. You work with them to promote innovation and adoption and all of these things. And so they're just different problems once you, depending on how you frame it.
Since 1883, Ultrasource has been a trusted supplier to the food industry. Ultrasource provides superior kill floor, processing, packaging, and labeling equipment and operational supplies.
And I really liked how you pointed out, like in 2015, and it's just everywhere, right? In 2050, we had to be more efficient. We had this conversation on every animal that we process, we have to make sure that every pound of it is available to be consumed. So we owe it to the animal. Has to be all sustainable. So from your perspective and your consultant, so you work with the government, with the private industry, academia. So what is needed to? I mean, do you think it's an extra step? Do you think I know from USDA, there's more focus on that about just tackling food waste. We talk about Europe that somehow they, like in France, if there's like a pound of even bananas that is thrown away at the store gets a fine. So, and that's been going on for a few years. So what do you think is the next step to combat food waste?
Yeah. So, I think that there's some interesting things happening in the world today. I mean, 10 years ago, we weren't having many conversations about food waste, and there are a lot more of those happening now. So, you know, step one is awareness. And I think that it's good that different places are exploring different ways of addressing this, because I don't think we know what the proper solution is going to be. You know, in France, I haven't yet seen the data to show, you know, is it having a significant impact on reducing waste? I would expect that it would, but it could also, sometimes there are unintended consequences. So, you know, just an example in the US, when companies were encouraged to buy ugly fruit, you know, that seems like a great idea to reduce food waste. So what happened? Dramatic reductions in food going to food assistance programs, because that was food that the grocery stores were giving away before, and now you turned it into a valuable commodity.
Oh my.
And so, you know, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it, because we want people to think of, you know, food as food. But once you put a price on it, then you change who gets access to it. So that doesn't mean we don't do it, but there needs to be that awareness of what happens. So if you fine people for throwing away food waste, maybe they don't sell quite as much food. They're more careful. And that may mean prices go up because, you know, they have to monitor it more closely. And so most people benefit because there's less food waste, but the poorest people are actually hurt by that. And just an example of how things, you know, if tomorrow we could magically eliminate post-consumer food waste, you know, there's this idea that, well, all this food is wasted, so all those hungry people would be fed. But if you and I don't waste food, then grocery stores don't sell the extra food, and then farmers don't produce the food. There's a benefit of not growing, producing, manufacturing, and selling food that goes in the trash can, but there's no benefit to hunger, right? I mean, eliminating the food waste would probably bring costs down, so there would actually be some benefit, but it's not going to benefit people in faraway countries that have access to more food. Again, doesn't make it wrong to do it, but it doesn't. There are no silver bullets to any of these issues.
I like to talk to a lot of folks about the model of North American agriculture. And we've become an extremely efficient country, and we can produce that excess in many cases and export it to other countries that desire it or, you know, are willing to pay more for it. But I think what would be really cool too, and for all the animal scientists out there listening, is to take the information that we've gleaned and export that into some of these underdeveloped countries and help them just become better producers of livestock so that they can produce an excess. And yeah, it may cut into the bottom line a little bit, but ultimately we're going to be feeding a lot more people.
Yeah, I look at places like Europe where they're very focused on local agriculture and local sustainability, which is part of the reason that they're the largest importer of food in the world. And, you know, they're just choices and consequences. The U.S. and Europe both export about $150 billion of agricultural commodities a year. The U.S. is exporting corn, soy, wheat, and Europe is exporting beer, wine, whiskey, and cheese. Yeah. Now, I like my beer, wine, whiskey, and cheese. Anybody who knows me know that's true. But, you know, they're not feeding the 99%. We are. And, well, we're importing the environmental footprint for the world by producing all this extra food. They're exporting their environmental footprint to the world. And it's just important to understand those choices and consequences, because when you look at the small farms in Europe, that seems like a more idyllic system. It feels like it's working better for people. And it may be working better for the people on those farms, but it's not working better for the people in Brazil or other places that may be impacted by those decisions. And so it's hard to have that broader conversation because, you know, most people are just not aware of those broader consequences. But we need to find ways of bringing more people into that more nuanced conversation.
Could you tell us about your background? I think I'm very interested in knowing more about your background.
Yeah, well, I grew up in southern Indiana, and, you know, we had cornfields that came up to our backyard. And, you know, we were not farmers or anything, but my grandmother had a garden, and, you know, we spent every weekend there. And, you know, we had corn and peppers and green beans and strawberries and watermelon and cantaloupe. And, you know, we basically were smallholder farmers, and, you know, it was all organic because we had child labor, which is my brothers and me. And, you know, it wasn't until just years and years later that I looked back on my own experience and realized how involved I was in food production. But then educationally, I ended up getting degrees in psychology, chemistry, biology, a master's in environmental science, degree in law. On the other hand, my wife has the PhD in our family, a cell and molecular biologist. So I'm more like quantity of degrees, and she's more like quality of degrees. But that diversity, I think, really helped me to be able to sort of put on my psychology hat or my biology hat, environmental science hat, to look at things from different perspectives. And that's been quite informative for me.
Very well-rounded, I would say, to sell yourself. Don't sell yourself short, anyway. Tell us a little bit about your book.
Yeah. So my book, Why Smart People Make Bad Food Choices. One of the things that really struck me, I was writing some blogs for my website, and they're still up there, about consumer psychology and things like the halo effect. You know, you put a plant-based burger up there and 90% of people are buying it for health reasons, even though it's not necessarily healthier. And even those who produce it aren't saying it's a healthier product. And so it's interesting when most people are buying a product for the wrong reason and talking about things like decision fatigue. And, you know, there's no place where it's harder to make decisions than a grocery store, because you have literally thousands and thousands of decisions to make. You're doing it at the end of the day when you're tired. You know, you're trying to do the math of portion sizes.
And when you're hungry, that's the worst thing, going to the supermarket when you're hungry.
Right. On top of that, the entire grocery store has been designed to influence your choices. And so as I was writing this, you know, I began to think about the whole obesity epidemic, and 42% of Americans are obese, 75% of Americans are overweight or obese. It'll be 50% by 2050. And what struck me is we have never known more about health and nutrition in the history of the planet than we do right now, and we've never been more obese. We have never had more healthy food options in a grocery store, and yet we've never been more obese. We've never had better labeling on products and grocery and restaurant menus, and we've never been more obese. So I was just struck by what's going on. And so that's where the first part of the book is really the psychology of how our brain leads us to make bad choices. The second part of the book is really that environmental aspect. You know, how is our food environment nudging us to make those bad choices? Because, you know, it's not like we had more willpower in 1960 when nobody was obese. You know, we're cooking with Crisco. And yet somehow, and I mean, we all know we are moving more, but our entire foodscape, you know, snacking culture and all of these different things, you know, back in the 1980s, the dietary guidelines recommended less fat. And so all the companies started producing low-fat products, which is what you want them to do. But then the halo effect kicked in and we're like, oh, one cookie is good, whole bag, I'm going to lose weight, right? And you're like, no, that's not the way math works. You know, and so the psychology and we're doing things for one reason, but it was having the other effect. And so then the last part of the book is just, well, what would it take to reshape our food environment so that we never thought about food again in terms of stressing about it? And we could just lose 1 or 2 or 3 pounds a year. You wouldn't even know why, because, you know, we don't know, you know, we're not intentionally eating more food, but we're gaining weight. So why couldn't we reshape that? You know, and I, as a futurist, you know, I ask people, it's like, well, what future do you want? We all want a future in which people are, you know, healthy, but do you want a future in which we're healthy because we're counting calories all the time and we have an app that tells us what we can and can't eat? Or do we just want to eat whatever we want to eat and we magically are fine because our food environment has nudged us in the right direction? And that could be portion sizes. It could be, you know, to help in the environment that we eat in, you know, the number of people you eat with, the lighting, all of these things are like nudging us. And so the book is really about, you know, what would it take to get us to that healthy, sustainable future in which we enjoy food again, which is where we started with this conversation.
Yeah, well, and you know, that's a great way to kind of land this plane, as they would say. And it's really interesting. You talk about the food culture in the 80s and kind of really starting in the 70s, but it definitely into the 80s, where fat was a 4-letter word. And in my family, my kids, it's not. And in fact, my boy, he's excited when he gets a pork chop with a little extra fat on there. He wants that. And he's never made the connection of fat being this unhealthy thing. Fat is just a word to describe this piece of tissue that's on a pork chop. And he really likes it. And it tastes good. And there's no way that he's overweight. He's as lean as they come. And so that's an interesting perspective.
Well, and in the book, there are hopefully some fun stories that people like, you know, obviously supersizing is, you know, crazy in the U.S., but, you know, you might not know that supersizing all goes back to the mad genius of one man, David Wallerstein. Back in the 1960s, he was the marketing guy for a movie theater chain, and they wanted him to sell more concession. So he's trying to figure out, how do we get people to buy more popcorn? And he tried different 2-for-1 deals and all these things to try to get people to buy more popcorn, and they just wouldn't do it. And it finally struck him, what if people are embarrassed to go back for a second bag of popcorn? And so he hit on the idea of offering a jumbo-sized popcorn. Sales took off. He later went to work for McDonald's, told Ray Kroc, you got to offer larger sizes. Ray Kroc said, people want a second bag of fries, they'll go back and get a second bag of fries. No. And it wasn't until 1972 he finally convinced him to offer a large size fry. And of course, the rest is history. But, you know, it's surprising. It's not that long ago. And it like seems like a pretty obvious thing to do. But before that, there was a mental block that people thought that offering a larger size was a form of discounting, and discounting undermined the value of your product. And so people just didn't do it.
Observing, I think, is key. Right. I think we had a conversation with Diana Huerta from Sealed Air a while ago, and she was able to develop some patterns by observing. I mean, not just looking at things, and by doing that, taking the moment to step back and just think through what's going on, you'd be able to come up with those ideas and things.
Well, bringing that back to food waste, when I was working for the State Department, you know, we were trying to figure out, how do you address food waste in places like Kenya? And the government solution was, well, maybe we need more on-farm storage, which, you know, kind of makes sense. But, you know, if you thought about it from a company perspective, is that really how a Costco or somebody else would solve that problem? Probably not. They'd go to just-in-time deliveries and other things where, you know, their food wasn't wasted because they're picking it up on time. And so, you know, again, thinking about what's the right solution in that environment, not just what we think the right one is, but, you know, what actually fits within the framework of that community and culture.
And by being multidisciplinary, like yourself with different background, can really help you just connect those dots from the psychology standpoint, but also, I mean, with all that stuff. So I think it's good to be well-rounded in and trying to approach those things from a multidisciplinary standpoint.
Well, and I think the people listening, you know, that's a good message anyway, because, you know, it used to be you could go and work for one company and spend your entire career there. But we know that today most people will have multiple jobs in their life, and they'll also have multiple careers. And so beginning early to think about, you know, what is your next career? What does that mean? Having that more open mindset as to, you know, what you can do with a degree in meat science or something is helpful.
Yeah, that is true. And even when you just get caught on stuff, you have to think about the future. And even if you're just doing your stuff, you have to, okay, when am I going to be in 2-3 years? And start working on that too, like on the, yeah. So this has been good.
This has been wonderful. And I encourage everyone to look into why smart people make bad food choices. I'm excited to learn a lot more about it. Do you have a website?
Yeah. So I'm at futurityfood.com, F-U-T-U-R-I-T-Y. And on Twitter, Jack_A_Bobo. They can follow me there. If people want to connect to me on LinkedIn, happy to do that as well.
You're on Instagram too.
And on Instagram, Futurity Food. Still building that one. So.
All right. Well, thank you a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. It's a lot of fun.
This is great. Thank you.